Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum, a venue for spoken word presentations in many forms. We feature writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. I'm your host, John O'Brien. Since 1976, 1,413 people have been executed in the United States. That number rose steadily through 1999, when 98 people were executed. Last year, 35 people were put to death. In a study published in 2014, University of Washington professor Catherine Beckett found that, quote, jurors in Washington are three times more likely to recommend a death sentence for a black defendant than for a white defendant in a similar case, unquote. Soon after that study was published, Washington Governor Jay Inslee announced that he would not carry out any death penalty sentence, but instead issue a reprieve in all capital cases brought before him. Inslee justified his decision this way.
Equal justice under law is the primary responsibility of our state. And in death penalty cases, I am not convinced equal justice is being served. The use of the death penalty in this state is unequally applied, sometimes dependent on the size of the county's budget involved where the crime occurred.
Inslee also referred to doubts about the deterrent effect of the death penalty and his hope that his decision would prompt a deeper discussion of capital punishment in the state. Can there be justice in the imposition of capital punishment? Humanities Washington hosted a deeper discussion of issues surrounding the death penalty at the Royal Room in Columbia City on May 27, 2015. The Think and Drink event was moderated by KUOW's Ross Reynolds. Featured guests were Dorothy Van Soest, a writer and former dean at the University of Washington, and David E. Smith, an instructor for the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, also at UW. Thanks to Anna Tadashev for our recording. Humanities Washington's Caroline Epstein kicked off the conversation.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining us tonight for our Think and Drink. Thank you, Royal Room, for hosting us. For those of you who don't know about Humanities Washington, who is hosting this event tonight, Humanities Washington is a private nonprofit sparking conversation and critical thinking by using story as a catalyst. So I know typically we don't associate the death penalty with having some drinks with our friends. And if you frequently do, please seek help. But in all seriousness, this is a topic that is so relevant and so important right now, and something that is so interesting for us to sit and talk about together. And so I'm so excited to have this fabulous panel with us. And without further ado, I will hand it over to our moderator, Ross Reynolds.
And, I'm always looking for a news peg for stories that we do. And those of you who have been following the news today saw that the state of Nebraska abolished the death penalty. It's the first time that's been done by a conservative state in 40 years, and the legislature overruled a veto by the governor. So there's actually news on this today. But the death penalty is always a timely issue because there's nothing the government, which represents us, does that's more serious than putting someone to death. This issue has evolved so much over the years, and Washington Governor Jay Inslee has declared a moratorium on the death penalty here, as you might know, that will last as long as he's governor. We'll find out what happens after that. We were thinking a lot about the death penalty the last couple weeks ago when a jury in Boston sentenced Boston Marathon bomber Dzhokhar Tsarnaev to death. Now, I've been covering this issue for about 40 years. Back in the 70s, those of you who are old enough or have studied this might remember there was a moratorium nationally on the death penalty from 1972 to 1976. Today, the United States is the only Western democracy that has not banished the death penalty. At the end of last year, there were over 3,000 inmates on death rows. That was down from 12% from 10 years before. So the number's gone slightly down. Of those, 43% were white, 42% were black, 13% were Latino or Latina. There are 9 people on death row here in Washington State. Jonathan Lee Gentry has been on death row for 23 years. Gary Ridgway, the Green River Killer, who was convicted of 48 separate murders and has confessed to nearly twice that number, is not on death row. Public support for the death penalty has dropped, although it's still a majority of Americans who support it, 63%. But back in 1994, it was 80%. California has the most people on death row, followed by Florida, Texas, and Alabama. Now, this is an issue that just gets more and more complicated the more that you look at it. There are so many facets to it. There's a spiritual factor. Do we believe the Bible of eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, or the Bible of thou shalt not kill? The numbers of people on death row, as I just mentioned, show a racial bias. There have been cases of people executed because they were innocent. It's incredibly expensive to prosecute death penalty cases because the appeals stretch on for years, much more expensive than it is to lock people up for life. Is that a reason not to have the death penalty? Is life in prison a harsher penalty than the death penalty, or those years of living on death row? So many things to think about. We're going to try to get to some of them this evening. And we did this last night, so we've had a chance to practice. So this is going to be, that was the dress rehearsal. This is the real deal. And a great panel who are going to take different perspectives and different ways of looking at this to this evening. Dorothy Van Soest is a professor emeritus at the University of Washington. She's a social worker and an activist and an author of 9 books, including this one, Just Mercy, which is a novel kind of based on some of her work about the death penalty, and that's one of the themes of this novel. Also with us this evening, David E. Smith. He has a PhD in religious studies from Temple University, and he currently teaches for the Osher Lifelong Living Institute at the University of Washington. They have classes all over the city on a variety of issues. So I'm going to start this evening by asking each of you, and I'll start with you tonight, David, do you think Americans are aware of the complexities of this issue? And if not, what do you think they leave out?
I think probably most people are not familiar with it because it is a very complicated issue, has many aspects to it. And I think people have convictions about this thing. Some people are undecided. Others have strong convictions on either side of it. But it's really easy just to have great confidence in your own belief system, especially if you've held it your whole life. And unless you really look into this and intentionally look at listen to stories, different kinds of stories, look at the facts, and look at arguments on both sides, then you're not going to be fully informed about it. And who's fully informed anyway? I mean, there's always more to learn about this. So I would put us all in that category, actually.
Are there any areas that you think this debate really ignores a lot? Any particular areas that you think are not mentioned enough when we debate this?
I don't think I can generalize for people. I think it varies from person to person and what kind of exposure they've had to the issue.
Dorothy, how about you? Do you think Americans are aware of the complexities of this issue when you look at the debates going on? And if not, what do you think is left out?
Yeah, I don't think we are aware of the complexity of it, because I think that the death penalty is as complex as the people who are impacted by the death penalty, which in my opinion includes all of us. And yet I don't think that the dominant discourse captures that complexity at all. When I first start to talk to people about the death penalty, almost to a person, the first thing they talk about is the crime itself, the heinousness of the crime. And by focusing on that, and the gruesome details and the suffering of the victims, understandable as it is, it's not a bad place to start. It's a natural place to start. It's where I would start. When I imagine one of my grandchildren being brutally murdered by somebody, I immediately have a visceral reaction that wants revenge. However, if I stay at that point, so I understand that, I get that, and the media supports that narrative. And if we get stuck there, it's like looking at the proverbial elephant. You look at the tusk or you look at an ear and you think you know what an elephant looks like. But there are many stories of people impacted by the death penalty. There are the people, the victims, and their loved ones, of course. And my heart goes out to them immediately whenever I hear of a crime. But there's also the life of the murderer, and the murderer has family members. And then there are the cops, the judges, the juries, the people who work inside the penitentiary, the people who try to recover and heal from losing someone in this way. There, the stories of people who just read about other people's stories, like me, and are tremendously impacted by it. And those are the stories that we don't we don't get much coverage on in the media, or we don't talk about much, we don't listen to much. The more stories we listen to, the more complex I think this issue becomes.
Dorothy, you've talked about fatal flaws in our stories right. about the death penalty. How can a story be flawed, and what do you mean by that?
First of all, I think that I've just what I just mentioned is focusing primarily on the crime and the murderer and what's going to happen to the murderer, the trial, et cetera, is in and of itself, when that's to the exclusion of telling other stories around that particular situation, that's a fatal flaw in and of itself. So you only get one piece of the elephant. The other thing is, I think that fatal flaw is grounded in a fatal flaw in our collective consciousness, the space in our society where we don't think about it, but there's what we consider to be normal and acceptable behavior. What is normal and acceptable punishment in the United States is still the death penalty is included in that, even though support for it is diminishing. But I think that a fatal flaw in the underlying collective consciousness that we just operate under as if it's the air we breathe and the water we drink and we don't question it are things like violence is necessary to solve problems. It's like one-up, one-down thinking where there have to be winners and losers. It's a competitive way of thinking. You know, you either win or you lose. And that really leads to a logical point where we say, well, wait a minute. Whose stories get heard? Who gets to be our storytellers? What do we hear from the media? What do we hear from people? Or do we poo-poo it? One of the biggest flaws I think we have is grows from the flaw of focusing only on the horrendousness of the crime. Because then the only way you can portray the murderer is as a remorseless, evil monster. And fatal flaws grow from that story, like the death penalty will protect us from those monsters. If you show people that killing is wrong, they'll stop killing people. It will bring relief and comfort to the loved ones of the victim. All those stories flow from the first story that it's so horrendous that we can't stand to think anything else about it.
Stories can kind of whipsaw us on one side or the other depending on how well they're told. What role do you think these stories have in this discussion of the death penalty, David, and what role should they not have?
Well, as a philosopher approaching this from a rational point of view, I think it's essential to listen to stories. I just don't think that stories by themselves tell you what your view should be. So I think good philosophy should always be connected to real life, real people, and real stories. And when I talk about these things, I do my very best to integrate stories. But at some point, as you said, you can come up with stories that would seem to imply both sides of the issue are correct, and in the end, you have to make up your mind. So I think stories should feed our thinking, but then we have to somehow turn that into a rational analysis of this thing and look at good reasons to follow the death penalty and good reasons not to.
You've talked about how it's important to be consistent in our thinking about moral issues. How does one's opinion on the death penalty kind of compel one to have opinions on other issues if one is to be consistent?
Yeah, well, first of all, in defense of consistency is a central rational virtue. Consistency allows me or enables me to avoid chaos in my mind. I mean, it really is true that two contradictory beliefs can't both be true. So I always seek to be consistent in my own thinking and try to inspire other people to do it. But it gets a little tricky when you look at other issues, even though I encourage people to do it. What's my view of abortion? What's my view of physician-aided dying? What's my view of killing in war or self-defense, right? So these issues, euthanasia, active euthanasia, do we want to take that next step? So there are always the challenge here is to, you know, look at both the similarities in all of these activities that end life, but also recognize the differences. And if I can be clear in one area, then it can help me as an analogy to try to bring clarity to an issue where I may be struggling.
Before we go any further, I'd like a show of hands of how many of you really know exactly how you feel about the death penalty. And how many of you are still unsure about how you feel about the death penalty? Oh, kind of a good mix here. I'd like you to, we haven't talked about the exact issues, and there are a lot of specific issues with the death penalty. We've kind of had a meta discussion. I'd like you each to take a moment and talk about what you think are the strongest issues, are the strongest arguments on behalf of the death penalty, and the strongest arguments and a strong argument against the death penalty. Maybe one of each that comes to mind immediately. Dorothy?
I think the strongest argument against the death penalty is that I believe it diminishes all of us as human beings. There are a lot of other arguments I could give that are debated all the time, but that comes down to the bottom line. For the strongest argument I think there is against the death penalty. Interesting, thinking about this question took me a long time because I wanted to be honest with myself about it, and I guess that where I came down is when someone has, in the immediacy of the moment and in the middle of their authentic experience of having lost a loved one at the hands of another person, and their concrete feelings in that moment require that the person that murdered their loved one be killed. That, to me, in that moment, is the strongest argument anybody could give me.
Feelings of revenge.
In that moment when you're in the middle of complete and total utter loss and the horrendousness of it all, right.
David, how about you? Top of mind, strongest arguments for, strongest argument against the death penalty.
I think, in my judgment, the two strongest arguments in favor of the death penalty, and they're related, they're sort of two sides of the same coin. Number one, when I talk about human rights, my moral theory is based on a foundation of human rights theory. So in human rights theory, we have all kinds of interesting things to discuss, but one of the things that we generally recognize is that rights are ours to lose. Rights can be forfeited. So anytime you punish someone, anytime the state punishes somebody, what we're implying is they have forfeited a right that was theirs. It might be a temporary forfeiture, it might be permanent, depending on what it is. So if I have to pay a $150 fine for a speeding ticket, I have forfeited my right to private property, $150 worth. If we put someone in prison, we are saying they have forfeited the right to liberty. Short-term, long-term, permanently, rights forfeiture. So one of the strongest arguments in favor of the death penalty is if you intentionally take the life of an innocent person, you have forfeited your right to life and you no longer have it, which is related to the other side of the coin, and that's that many people feel that the death penalty is just, that the murderer is getting what he deserves. In my judgment, the strongest arguments against the death penalty. First of all, would be the life story, and this is where Dorothy is, and her methodology is so essential. The life stories of the murderers, and I agree with you, we would rather not think about that. And I worry that the story of the victim actually gets lost if we go down this path, but at the same time, she and I agree, even though our methodology is different and our view of this is different, I think we agree that when you read the life story of some of these murderers and the horror of their childhood, to recognize that things that were imposed on them against their will that they didn't choose have shaped them and formed them and made them what they were. So that's one argument I find compelling. And the other one, I think, for me is convicting the innocents. I can't think, and this has been something with me my whole life, I can't think of anything worse than being an innocent person and being convicted of any crime, especially a serious crime that carries any serious penalty. And that is something that I think is a compelling argument against it.
One of the arguments that's used for the death penalty is that this person will never murder again. It deals with that aspect of the issue, that
yes.
That's never going to happen again. Do either of you think that's an important argument to make?
I think it's a legitimate argument. One of the things I inspire people to do or challenge people to do is look at all the arguments that are in circulation and weigh them for yourself, you see? So I that is definitely an argument that's in circulation, and there's some merit to it. I mean, sometimes we put convicted murderers in prison and they murder other inmates. Sometimes they murder a prison guard. Occasionally, and this is very rare, they actually escape and pose a threat to others. So, yeah, if you put them to death, they're not going to repeat the offense.
Dorothy?
Wow. The first thing that comes to mind in response to that is, no, they will never murder again, nor will they have a chance to be restored to humanity. So I don't... It wouldn't be an argument that would sway me to say, yes, we need the death penalty because they'll never do it again.
One of the interesting comments last night was from a woman who got up and said, it's almost more merciful to put someone to death than to require them to live in prison for the rest of their life. What a horrible existence that would be, particularly the state of some of our supermax prisons in this country. That's a much worse imprisonment. She was talking about almost as merciful to put someone to death. What about that argument?
Yeah, that simple observation or question, what is more severe, life in prison or the death penalty? Just that simple question shows just the kind of the edge of the complexity of this thing, because it is possible to make the case that the death penalty is more merciful than life in prison. That's a value judgment in some cases, and we all hate to even think this way, but you know, I think that reason requires imagination, and I've asked myself, if I were convicted of murder and I had the option of receiving the death penalty or having life in prison, I'm not convinced that that the death penalty is the worst option there. So that depends, I guess, on your judgment. And there are some people that actually oppose a death penalty because they want a more severe penalty than death. I've heard that argument from people.
Dorothy, how about that? Is the death penalty less severe than life in prison?
I think it depends on the prison.
Yeah, that's true.
some are hell holes and some are better than others. And one thing I learned from studying the life stories of the 37 men who were executed by the state of Texas in 1997 was the high percentage of them that had ADHD and while on death row functioned much better than they had been able to outside because there was structure. Wasn't so bad then. I guess last night the question was in relation to we euthanize our pets.
Yeah.
And that just kind of threw me, and it
right.
still kind and of throws
exactly.
me.
Exactly. I mean, talking about a human as a pet was a little bit weird, but I think the idea that I got from it was the thought was it's a horrendous thing to be on death row for the rest of your life.
Well,
to
the scenario that woman portrayed was someone in a convicted murderer, life in prison, who is so internally distorted that they can't even be with the rest of the prison population. They're such a danger to others. And you have to put them in isolation, and they're just absolutely miserable. And that was the context in which she made the comment that I thought was worth considering. So are we being merciful to that person by putting them in isolation long term, and there's really no hope of restoring them? People who work in the system, I think, generally agree not everyone can be restored, not everyone can be fixed. So is it really merciful to leave them in isolation like that? And I don't have a certain answer to the question, but it was worth asking.
Dorothy?
You can tell I'm really uncomfortable. I'm not God. Who am I to decide what's merciful for somebody else? Putting somebody to death is more merciful than I would argue much more strongly for humane prisons.
Yes.
Than merciful killing. So that whole idea has got me thinking, which again in my framework would be instead of trying to decide what would be better, would it be better to put them to death or have them on death row? I'd want to know more about that person, the prison, the guards, the murder victims' loved ones. I'd like to, you know, fill myself up with as much information and pray to God that I'm never the one that has to make that decision.
I'm going to want to go to your questions and comments shortly. So if you've got some or you just like to express a viewpoint on this, I really want to hear it. We have the microphone in the back. But I have a particular interest in one angle of this, and that is if we are going to execute people, should we be doing that on television? If the state is going to enact this penalty and we feel that it's appropriate to do that, or even if we feel it's inappropriate to do that, should it be something that we, with our government acting in our stead, should be able or willing to witness, to see?
I see enough horrible things on TV already, and I think that what happens is we get desensitized. Probably there's a way of thinking that if we saw it, we would be abhorred and we would be against it. But if we saw it and then we saw it and then we saw it, just like when I was in Texas, the year that they executed 37 men, by the end of that year, executions were getting one little paragraph in the back page of the newspaper. It was just, ho-hum, another execution. So it worries me that we could get desensitized and just go, oh, another execution. Well, I have something else to do. I don't want to bother. But it might work. I don't know. There's a transparency issue. If we're going to do this, we should do it in broad daylight and not at 2 a.m. in the morning or at midnight like they tend to do in Huntsville, Texas. David?
Well, I have to think a little bit more about the TV angle, but I guess my tendency here is to say something in between what we currently do and just putting it on TV for everyone. A story that I can tell is before I came to the state of Washington a few years ago, I taught philosophy and religious studies for many years in Indiana, and they had a scheduled execution. And as an ethicist, I wanted to have the experience of witnessing it. So I contacted the prison officials, told them who I was. I'm nothing controversial here as an ethicist. I want to witness this and be able to process this for myself, and they wouldn't allow it. Hmm. So I was really disappointed in that. I mean, I think that kind of an opportunity, if you're willing to make the effort to go and you witness it and you're really trying to think about this in a fair and balanced way, then you should be able to do it.
I interviewed Jerry Spence, this famous defense attorney, one time, and one of the things he said that stuck with me, he says, there's no justice in America. There's justice if you're wealthy and you can afford a good attorney, but there's not really justice in America. Does the obvious racial disparity of application of the death penalty, and I'm sure if you looked a bit deeper, you'd find that wealthy people have a better record when it comes to getting off on murder. Is that at all something we need to take into account when this is public policy still in many states?
Yes.
How do we
That's another argument that's another argument in favor of abolition. And it's a legitimate argument and one that has to be weighed in the context of all the other arguments that on that side of it, as well as the arguments in favor of it. But is it a legitimate argument? Absolutely.
Dorothy, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I would not stop with just the racial and economic disparities of the application of the death penalty. I would go further back and say, look at who... Well, first of all, Danielle, you may remember, somebody was asked once, has there ever been a case of somebody who is wealthy, who got the death penalty? The answer was a simple no. It's obvious that this is totally skewed. But I'd go back to the people who get executed, what happened to them from the day they were born or even in utero up until the time they committed a capital crime. And you will see that before the injustice of them getting poor defense and getting the death penalty, there's a lot of injustices that happen when you don't have money.
But how do you account for the fact that there are lots of people who go through a lot of hard things in life who don't murder?
Well, the only thing I could say about that is based on my research. I studied the 37 men. I divided them into two categories because I had to.
These were 37 men on death row?
On death row. 37 men who were executed by the state of Texas in 1 year. when they broke their first record of how many they executed. I had to divide them into two categories because of the nature of the crimes. And one category I called the most heinous because they were extreme rage, multiple weapons, a lack of remorse, just horrible, horrible stuff. The other category was young men, usually men of color, more often men of color in this category, who got funneled into the juvenile justice system for some things that they did. The criminalization process began. They experimented or got involved heavily with drugs and alcohol, and they went to rob a 7-Eleven, or they were speeding, and a cop stopped them, and they had a gun, and they killed them, or the gun went off, and somebody died. It was an immediate capital case in Texas. Those were two very different life stories. In the second category, those people, if they had not gotten the death penalty, if they had not been executed, they probably would have made it. They probably could have made it in society. The first category of people were so damaged. So what the sense I make out of that is some people are much more damaged by life experience and a combination. Like, for example, it's much more damaging to be physically and sexually abused plus be neglected than it is to be physically abused without being neglected on top of it. The combination of that combination research shows. So I think it isn't just a simple matter of resilience. It's a matter of the combination of risk factors that hit somebody in their life. And some of those men, the crimes that they committed were freaky because they were paralleled some horrible things that had happened to them in their lives. It was like they just cashed it in for a big one at the end. And so that's the only answer I can give.
So some people have a really rough upbringing and they don't commit the crimes. That's your question. How do we process that, right? You're touching on a larger question that is a really important one for me. As a philosopher, I deal with the question of free will and what it is, whether it's real. And I don't mind admitting, I admit this to my classes all the time, I know of one inconsistency in my own mind, and I'm aware of it, and I don't know how to solve it. And I think sometimes, hopefully that's a lesson. Yeah, well, I'm only aware of it, you see? I often will ask my class, how many of you agree that probably everybody in this room is wrong about something? Is that fair? Everyone? Why don't you change your mind? Because you don't know what it is, right? You don't know what you're wrong about, but that fundamental observation should make us intellectually humble and always open-minded to listening to other stories, other arguments, other facts, and so on. So there is a problem I have in my mind. I lean toward a view of free will that is a very the popular view of free will is that human beings have both the ability and the opportunity to choose between options, right? But that seems obvious to a lot of people, but it's actually not when you put it under the microscope. So you can make a case that people do what their genetics, what their upbringing, their life experience, what all of those things have created them to be, that we always do that. So, but the problem here is if I go too far down that path, then nobody's responsible for anything. And at some point, and this is touching on your question, at some point, we have to hold adults responsible for what they do. We can't really function in a world with no accountability, no responsibility, and everybody's a victim at that point. So I'm admitting in front of the world here that I'm not sure how to resolve that. I think that to a large extent, we all do what DNA and experience have sort of set us up to do. And yet we have to hold each other accountable. So I'm still working on it.
Dorothy's got another comment, but go to the microphone if you've got a question or a comment for our panelists. We'd like to hear what you have to say, too.
First of all, this is good debate or discussion. First of all, I don't think that understanding why somebody did something is equal to not holding them accountable.
Right.
But the one thing I thought of was a woman last night in the audience who spoke and talked about her adopted daughter who had fetal alcohol syndrome and that she gets violent. She cannot think rationally. She cannot make rational decisions. That she could it's very possible that she could end up hurting somebody, even murdering somebody. And yet, to apply that standard of free will to everybody without considering who they are and what hand they've been dealt in life, I think it's... You need to think about that a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Yes, what's your name and your comment or your question?
Yes, my name is Dave Langton, and I'm just thinking, maybe somebody can help answer the question. In some places now, if we have a terminal illness, we are allowed to end our life. Is this a discussion with people in this situation? Are they allowed to decide, or have, as you mentioned earlier, they've given up their free will to make decisions on their own? So can somebody who has committed such a heinous crime like this, who ultimately might be up for the death penalty, can they decide to
be death killed? With dignity laws, as I understand them, and I think they're the same from state to state, they have requirements, and one is that you have 6 months or less to live, mm-hmm. that you have yeah. doctors testify that you're not depressed, that you're not clinically depressed, mm-hmm. so that's kind of feeding into the decision. And you have to have a couple of doctors to do that. So I don't know that someone on death row could make the former argument unless they were indeed seriously ill. So I don't think legally there's a way they could do that. But as we know, there are many people all over this country who don't have death with dignity laws, but also can figure out ways to end their lives.
I have as a keeper of stories, and I love asking questions and hearing stories, I've heard some stories of some men on death row who have attempted suicide, who have chosen to take their own life, and the prison system has done everything they could to bring them back and not allow that to happen so that the state can do it, to take that control away from them.
Yes.
Yes, sir, your name and your question, your comment.
Well, my name is Tim Kerr, and... I wanted to kind of go back to when we were discussing which is worse, capital punishment or a life sentence.
Yes.
And this last spring, I attended the murder trial of Thomas Dean Bowman, who maybe you remember he shot the wine steward at the Broadway QFC at a... intersection in North Seattle, and I had some time. I went to a few of the sessions, and this man was so, I'm kind of breaking up, but this man was so smart. He had money, he had guns, he had cars, he had a beautiful wife, but he decided he needed to kill somebody, and just for the kind of the sport of it, and then cover up his tracks. And it was just so fascinating to listen to this man in his bland way try and explain his way out of it. And I really think he thought he was going to get away with it. And when the sentence was made, because he went for broke, he didn't think the state could prove first-degree murder. And the jury came back with guilty on that, and that was the first sign of emotion the man showed during the trial, the part that I saw. Well, he was sentenced to, I think, basically 23 years plus 3 years of community supervision after that. And I just think that will be like a living hell for him in that case. I think far worse than any death penalty conviction or a verdict that he could have gotten.
So you felt that was appropriate?
That was, yeah. And just, I think when I went out of that room, I mean, I just had a nodding acquaintance with Yancey Noel. It just was like, what a friggin' waste of both, you know, Yancey Noel's life and this guy who just thought he was so smart he could outwit the system.
Wow. Thank you very much.
Had any psychological tests been done on him?
Oh, I'm sure.
I just wondered, you know, it sounds like you're describing sociopathic behavior. I don't know.
Well, yeah, that was kind of, I mean, I'm not a scientist, so I couldn't say whether it was, but just his whole demeanor and everything was, you know, and his parents are sitting there, and You know, it's just like, man, it still kind of haunts me. Even now, I think my wife is tired of me talking about it from time to time, but it was a fascinating sort of process.
Thank you for sharing it.
Yeah, thank you. And who's this young woman?
My name is Caroline. Thank you. And my question is about states that have already abolished the death penalty. So I know in recent years there have been several. And I'm a little curious about this. Some of them who have abolished, I don't know if it's all of them, maybe Danielle, you can clarify that. Even though they abolished the death penalty, their repeal did not, it was not retroactive. So people that were already on death row remained on death row, despite the abolition of the death penalty in their state. So I was wondering what your thoughts were on that, both of you.
But they won't be executed, right?
No, they will be.
They will be executed. Yeah. Except for Maryland.
I don't think I have a thought on it. I'll have to think about it. Yeah, I mean, I can see the reasoning behind it because the decision was already made. The sentence was already imposed, and I guess that's what they're thinking.
I say bad luck, man. I mean, if something is right, this is the thing about the political process. You know, the political process is slow and chaotic, and so you got all these inconsistencies, and people get caught in this, you know. Yeah. So somebody could do something even worse and not get the death penalty, whereas somebody, you know, is going to get the death penalty.
I guess you'd have to figure out.
It's just not right.
If you don't want that to happen, you'd have to have a new sentencing, right? Somehow you'd have to come up with something different.
Sir, did you have a question or a comment?
Yeah. So I think I know where I stand on this issue, but one case that comes into mind every time is Anders Breivik, the guy who killed 70 children in Norway.
Oh, yes.
And I know. In that case, he took 70 kids' lives. I'm sure he was a sociopath, you know, a lot of psychological disorders there. But, you know, you have Norway who has, you know, I think he's going to get like 10 years in prison is the max sentence. So what do you guys think about that?
I think 10 years in prison is way too light, if that's the truth. I'm familiar with the story. I remember it. I don't know all the details, but I would that would offend me.
I would want there to be serious rehabilitative attempts, a plan, a program, something, not just sit in jail for 10 years.
I think there are.
Before somebody would be let out, because if somebody's a danger to society, and I would want that to be very rigorous. On the other hand, I've read a lot about the prison system in countries like that, and I'm impressed with how they are willing to go beyond the revenge and the vengeance and the punishment to look at other third ways, even beyond rehabilitation. You know, there's usually rehabilitation, there's punishment, but there's also restorative programs, and they're willing to look at those and try those. So I think we could learn a lot from them, but it's scary to think about somebody who could be out without being changed.
Thank you. Yes, your name and your question or comment.
Hi, my name is Julie, and I know that historically there's been a lot of catastrophes that have influenced whether or not we have the death penalty. So I wondered, like, right now, my daughter who's with me tonight has really never known a life without war. And she's lived a world where there's been awful catastrophes, one after another. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, like, how is this going to change the dialogue? How is this going to change the conversation as we move forward? And will it change the conversation? Because it seems to have changed public opinion a little bit. So I'm just wondering what your thought is about where we're moving in this whole conversation.
On the death penalty itself, yeah, on other issues?
On the death penalty, because you think about whether it's the Civil War, World War I, World War II, Nazi Germany. You think about what's going on at Guantanamo, however you say this word, Bay. You think about civil rights being taken away from people. Just the horrible things we've learned about what our own government does with terrorism. And I just wondered how these conversations are going to change how we feel about this, because it's changed for me. So what is your feeling about that?
Well, public opinion, as I mentioned earlier, is moving away from the death penalty. We know that. What factors are involved with that, I don't know. Any thoughts on where we're going with public opinion? And I mean, this decision today by Nebraska is kind of a surprise. I'm looking forward to finding out more about how it happened in Nebraska, of all places, banning the death penalty.
A thought I have in response to what you said, which is broader than the death penalty, but even just focusing on the death penalty, is something we talked about last night, which we haven't touched on yet, the difference between debating something and dialoguing about something. And I think that as long as we debate these issues, where the goal is to win, then I will listen to you to find a flaw in your argument so I can counter your argument so I can win, as opposed to sitting down face to face, looking in each other's eyes and listening to each other's stories of how we're impacted by whatever is going on with our hearts. That's what I think will change the culture. The politics will follow if enough of the culture changes, so that what is considered normal and acceptable in our culture shifts so dramatically. I mean, an example would be marriage equality. I mean, the politicians are scrambling to catch up right now. How did that happen? It happened because family members talked to their friends and other family members about, or they went to their weddings, or they knew a personal story, and they loved somebody who had a story that they listened to. That's how I think it's going to change, not with the old way of thinking, which is you got to have winners and losers, one up, one down. That's going to keep us right where we are.
Anything to add?
This surprises some people as a philosopher. I'm not a huge fan of debate either, but I am a fan of taking all the arguments on both sides of everything and using those arguments for dialogue. In other words, trying to look at every argument, whether it's capital punishment or any other controversial moral issue. And I do this all the time in my contemporary ethics course. Look at every argument on both sides and not really have a debate, but just think about the power of each of those reasons. A good argument is just a good reason to believe something or do something, and I think that's what I try to do. So take the debate and the content of it and use that to guide a dialogue, because I think Dorothy's exactly right. If you're debating, you're not really listening to the value, the good point somebody's making. You're just trying to find a flaw in it, and that's pretty frustrating to me too.
Yes, sir. Your name and your question?
My name's Colin, and this may go a little bit beyond the scope. When I've talked with people about their opinions of the death penalty, the concept of evil has come up, whether someone can be inherently evil or whether we are just people and we can commit an evil act. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that concept and how it relates to the death penalty.
Oh, that's a good one.
Well, you know, at the end of the day, when you look at all the facts, you listen to all the stories, you look at all the arguments, I think about, and I did this since last night, just take a step back from all the complexity and say, what fundamentally is influencing me? What do I keep coming back to? And I come back to people like Ted Bundy. I think Ted Bundy was evil. Now, is there a difference between evil and severe mental illness? I don't know, but if you can do the kinds of horrible things to people, I mean, everybody in this room would admit you're not perfect, but you don't go out and do those things to people. So there is something inside people that makes them do horrible things, and if that's not evil, I don't know what it is. So it could be a semantics debate, ill or evil, and I think those are very much related to each other. But sure, I have no problem saying Ted Bundy was evil.
Wow, this conversation's going deep tonight.
Yeah.
I guess my initial response is I certainly can agree that there are evil acts. But I don't know. I think maybe each of us is has the potential to do a lot of good and the potential to do a lot of evil.
Yes,
things.
I agree with that.
I think when I get really enraged about something that's going on in the world, I want to kill. I mean, that is my visceral feeling. And I yell it at the TV when I'm watching the news. I don't like that part of me, but it's a part of me. But does that make me evil? And then the other question I would ask is anyone born evil? I don't know what people believe about a god or whatever, and we're not, that's way beyond the scope, and I'm not a religious person at all. But if there is a god, would God create evil people? Why?
No. I'd like to follow up on that, though. I'm going to appeal to Aristotle on this. Because on this point, I think he's very helpful. And I'm paraphrasing. He said, you become what you do if you do it enough. So you may get really angry at the TV, but you're not acting on that.
Yeah, okay.
You become what you do if you do it enough. I mean, if there's an isolated event, you did something that's not characteristic. I can't believe I did that. You get it under control. You learn from it. You move on. You haven't become that thing yet. But someone like Ted Bundy became what he did, in my opinion. And I think that's the right way to look at it. So no, he wasn't born evil, but I think he became evil by doing what he did so much. Are we ready to weigh in on our personal views? That's a segue, right?
Go.
I do. Yeah, I do. I support it for people like Ted Bundy.
I don't, but a story that goes along with the Ted Bundy, I did a Speakers Bureau presentation in Bellevue last week. And one of the women, I try to find people who have stories to tell about how they're impacted by the death penalty. And one woman who told her story, one of her friends was murdered by Ted Bundy. And she had come into the situation anti-death penalty. When her friend was murdered, she wanted him executed. She waited all those years. Waited and waited for him to be killed so that she would get relief, and then he was executed, and she waited for the relief, and it never came. And now she's back to opposing the death penalty and wanting to get involved with the Washington Coalition to abolish the death penalty. So I just wanted to tell that story. But I feel that... killing somebody, whether it's by the state or by an individual, diminishes the humanity of all of us, and I just can't support it.
Yes.
Hi, my name is Lily. So a point that I've been thinking about is we as a society are pretty far removed from the act of euthanizing someone, in essence. So, you know, it takes place in a room in the middle of the night. We don't get to see it. It's not publicly displayed. So, you know, when we see videos of, like, beheadings and we hear stories of people getting their hands cut off for stealing, where do we draw the line? And, David, you mentioned that people who are, you know, are premeditated and they're, like, conscious of their decisions. What about someone who is, like, texting and driving and happens to kill someone, or someone who decides to drink and drive and they kill someone? Do they, like, say this was a celebrity or a soccer mom, are we going to, should they be put to death for those crimes?
No, I don't think that they should, because there's a big difference between an accident that kills somebody and murder or vehicular homicide. And if you think about the difference, you know, and let's be honest with ourselves. Any of you who've been driving long enough know that you have probably been distracted at some point and could have hurt somebody. Okay? We've all done something. We were distracted. We ran the stop sign. We ran the red light. We started to swerve off the road. If you drive long enough, you're going to do something like that. So no, and the difference there is intention. And sometimes intention makes... The difference between an accident that includes a tragedy and murder is intention. That's a huge thing, and it doesn't seem that big, but it's huge. What were you trying to do when you left the house that day and you got in that car, right? So no, I wouldn't support the death penalty for something that's not intentional.
May I just add, the category of men who committed the least heinous crimes did not intend to murder. They intended to get money for their drug habit. It was accidental when the gun went off, and they got the death penalty.
We've only got a few minutes left because we need to finish this up at 5:30. So question or comment, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Twi, and I wanted to know about the theory of justice and the application of justice. So when we talk about theory of justice, we talk about intent and moral values, good and evil. But what I'm interested in is public policy. How do you respond to when over 130 people have been exonerated, some posthumously, from capital punishment cases? And I'm not for or against capital punishment. I'm interested in the sort of just application of punishment. And so when you talk about exoneration, as well as, you know, special cases like Ted Bundy, how do we discern who has been the receiver of justice and those who are clearly, like, sociopaths?
Well, let's see. I have a deep concern about juries. Everything you said is a legitimate point. And you can turn that into a good argument against the death penalty. You can do it. It's one of the arguments. And it's one of the two I identified as the, one of the two best.
But it's also a primarily race issue, too. I mean, 80% of people on death row are black men, and the people who commit crimes are not all black men.
That's right.
Right. No, those are valid points. Those are certainly things we should all consider in our view. I mean, I'm not sure exactly how to answer your question, except that the dilemma we have in our culture with jury trials is as follows, in my opinion. We have the right to a jury trial. It's constitutional. It's supposed to keep corruption out of it. It's supposed to create fairness because your peers will judge you. The problem is the average person who serves on a jury, in my judgment, doesn't know how to weigh evidence. They don't really know how to weigh the evidence. And you have some professional lawyers making persuasive arguments that may be substantial or may not be, and they may be manipulated. And it's a bigger question than just the death penalty. But I don't know how to turn this into policy, but if there's a reasonable doubt, we're not supposed to convict. And there's got to be a way, if there's a reasonable doubt that's discovered later, to do something about it. And I leave it to the policymakers to figure out how. But if there's a reasonable doubt, we can't follow through with it.
I'm sure David and Dorothy will stick around afterwards. But for the public portion of this, just one more comment here, please.
Okay, so my question is actually for David. In the beginning, you spoke about using rational arguments and rational thought to address this issue. Can you talk about why you felt that was an appropriate framework for analyzing something like this versus some of the other philosophical traditions?
We can't get through our day without reason, first of all. Everybody uses it. We just do. We do induction all the time. We're not even aware of the process. We gather evidences for different things. We draw conclusions. We turn them into other arguments. When you sit on a jury, I think it's fair to say you're morally and legally required to use reason to weigh evidence. You see, that's the only way I know to determine the truth, the best way. It's not foolproof. It's not infallible. But if somebody's accused of a crime, what we're essentially doing in criminal court is we're doing history. We're trying to figure out what happened. And the only way I know to determine what happened is to follow the evidence trail, and that requires reason.
Well, I guess I'm less concerned about its application to particular cases and more concerned about the idea of the death penalty, how you decided that was the proper framework.
Do you have an alternative you want to suggest to reason? No, I mean, reason is to be human is to have rational power. It's to have the ability to weigh evidence and arguments. Again, I like to use a synonym for the word argument. It's just a good reason to believe something or not believe something, and I don't know any other way to do it.
My rational powers tell me that our time is over. Thank you so much. Really great comments this evening, and I really appreciate that. And there's another program that's going to be here on June 30th. There are comment cards on your tables. If you could fill them out, that would be really terrific. That helps us formulate these so they'll be better in the future. And thank you so much to our guests. That was terrific. Dorothy's book, Just Mercy, available at fine bookstores everywhere.
Thank you, thank you.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you liked what you heard, you might leave a good review. It helps other listeners find us. Humanities Washington hosted this event at the Royal Room in Columbia City on May 27, 2015. This Think and Drink event was moderated by KUOW's Ross Reynolds. Featured guests were Dorothy Van Soest, a writer and former dean at the University of Washington, and David E. Smith, an instructor for the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, also at UW. Thanks to Anna Tadashev for our recording, and TVW for the audio from Governor Inslee. Tune in next week for another great talk. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.